Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Janine Dixon, the Educational Outreach Coordinator here at the Center for Science and Culture. Recently, talk radio host Michael Medved was gracious and eloquent in explaining the work we do at the Center for Science and Culture. He asked listeners to make their tax-deductible year-end contributions accordingly.
A great Christmas present for anyone on your list would be a contribution in someone's honor to the Center for Science and Culture of Discovery Institute. And anyone who gives $150 or more to Discovery Institute will have a beautiful gift edition of the magnificent new documentary. It is a nature documentary, kind of thing that would make Walt Disney proud, except no scientific questions about this one. This is very handsomely mounted and very carefully photographed and edited. It is called Flight, the Genius of Birds. And it actually asks some of the questions about the mysteries of these birds that have remarkably sophisticated functioning, and not just in terms of their flight.
Some of you may be considering giving a gift to your college alma mater, yet many of those same colleges and universities have contributed to the persecution of pro-ID scientists. There's a better way to direct gifts to the cause of educating future generations. That's by supporting the Center for Science and Culture. Any amount helps, but as Michael said, a $150 gift will get you a free DVD of Flight, the Genius of Birds. Please help us by going to intelligentdesign.org and making a year-end donation. That's www.intelligentdesign.org. Thank you, and now back to the podcast.
Hello, and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. We have on the show with us again today Dr. David Berlinski, a senior fellow at Discovery Institute. In our previous podcast, we were talking about Dr. Berlinski's responses to Steven Pinker, who is arguing that over time, society is becoming less and less violent and there's sort of this upward evolutionary progression of society to a less violent state. So let's pick up the conversation where we left off, Dr. Berlinski. I want to get back to what we were talking about earlier about the explosive rise in crime since the 1960s. But before we do that, I'd like to ask you for now, it seems like there may even be two different types of violence that we're talking about here. On the one hand, we're talking about just the average background rate of, say, homicides in a population in the city of London over 800 years. Normal citizens, are they getting along with each other or are they killing each other? And then there's another question of regime-based homicide, where you have one political group fighting against another or fighting against a certain population and killing people. And you mentioned at the beginning some of these fabulous examples of murder of the 20th century that Pinker kind of brushes to the side a little bit, saying, okay, yeah, there was World War II, there was Stalin, but these are anomalies. This is not what I'm talking about. There's sort of two different types of violence going on. And obviously, the 20th century is famous in large part for these political-based incidents of homicide where untold numbers of people were killed. So does Pinker, does that trouble him at all? And if not, what do you make of this? And should this be taken account if we're going to talk about whether humanity really is getting more or less violent?
Yeah, I mean, of course, I imagine it does trouble Pinker. No one born in the 20th century can afford with insouciance or indifference to ignore the real history of the 20th century. And Pinker, of course, acknowledges it. But what he does say, again, employing in his own defense a statistical method, is that if you look at the First and Second World War, certainly they were the great catastrophes of human history, but they're outliers, they're statistical outliers. And these things happen. If you believe, along with Lewis Richardson, on whom Pinker bases his work, that the outbreak of war is essentially random. It's controlled by a Poisson process. And that, although it is regrettable, it's unfortunate, given the essentially random nature of war, an outlier is to be expected every now and then. Now, this, of course, does not mean that Pinker is indifferent to this scale, the scope of human suffering. He just wants to encourage us to believe that it was just one of those things for which we have no deeper or better explanation than things like that happen in human history. They don't happen for any deeper reason. They happen essentially in a random or stochastic way, certainly described by a Poisson process, the number of dead or the number of injuries inflicted, basically fulfilling a power law distribution. This, again, is one of the bits of analysis in Pinker's book that I find extraordinary, because for a sophisticated guy, and Pinker has a background in statistical psychology, for a sophisticated guy, he seems not properly to understand the Poisson processes or the very nature of his own argument. What he says is, he uses a very engaging metaphor. War, here's how it happens. The god of war has a pair of iron dice. He rolls them, and if it comes up snake eyes, I'm almost quoting, I may have misplaced a comma. If it comes up snake eyes, he sends two countries to war. Are we to conclude from that that the fact that Sweden and Peru did not go to war in the 20th century is just a lucky break? If not, then his analysis could not possibly be correct. Mm-hmm. And it isn't correct. The analysis infected by a fallacy. It's quite true that if you look, as Richardson did, at the outbreak of war, it seems to obey a Poisson process, exponentially declining. There's a very small chance that there'll be 1,000 wars in any, not negligible, but very small chance there'll be 1,000 wars in any given day. A much greater chance there'll be 200, a much greater chance there'll be 1, and so on. We know exactly how those curves look. But to say that the outbreak of war satisfies a certain kind of distribution is not to say that it was caused by a random process. A certain kind of random process called a Poisson process leads to a Poisson distribution, but the converse is just false. And this is something every statistician understands, but remarkably enough, in all the comments about Pinker's book, nobody's gone back to the literature. And if you go back to the literature, you'll discover plenty of good political scientists who say, wait a second, that's not right. I mean, Poisson distribution is one thing, Poisson process is quite another. So his whole assessment of the random nature of warfare in the 20th century seems to me deeply, deeply flawed. In fact, it seems to me that between the First and Second World War, these are not independent events, but profoundly correlated, that everyone, including Clemenceau in France, knew that the end of the First World War would be followed by the Second World War. In fact, Clemenceau, I believe, said it would occur in 30 years, in 1918, which is exactly when it did occur. There were profound causal circumstances between the conflicts, and given the fact that wars are the expression of human society, it would be incredible if there were not deep principles and deep regularities by which laws are caused, regulated, controlled, adjusted, and settled.
Yeah, I mean, hundreds of millions of people don't just die for random reasons suddenly.
Sometimes they do in earthquakes.
Maybe. Yeah, that's true. But not by the hand of another man.
It's very hard to believe that. Yeah. It's very hard to believe. It's very hard to believe that either strict causality or randomness is an entirely adequate explanation for human affairs. For human beings.
And definitely not something that you can just write off if it doesn't fit your thesis. So I'd like to return back to, and maybe close this out in just a couple minutes here, but this explosive growth in crime since the 1960s. And obviously, yeah, this has perplexed sociologists. I know I've read some books about this myself. It is interesting that there seems to be this correlation between as we are better able to keep track of crime and what's going on, we see an increase. It's almost a positive correlation. As we get closer to the present, our records improve. And at that same period, we see this great increase. What does that mean? That's the big question here. What does it all mean? Why is this happening?
No one knows, Casey. No, I mean, that's the honest answer. Look, there's a very good reason why crime fell to historically low proportions in 1938 in Germany. A very good reason you don't see a lot of homicides. There's a very good reason that the lowest homicide rate in the history of Great Britain occurred in 1950. Almost everyone prone to violence had exhausted that capacity by 1950, or they were dead. Why crime rates should be increasing or have increased from 1960? Why in certain jurisdictions they declined in 1990 or 2000, whether they are fluctuating randomly, whether there's a deep reason for homicide of the sort that Emil Durkheim might have investigated, whether homicide is a reflection of a certain kind of disintegration in society, or whether on the contrary it's a manifestation of a certain kind of irrational ebullience, You know, criminology is not a very sophisticated science. Mm. Criminologists are very, very inclined to follow the herd. Mm. That is, Pinker has followed the lead of a very good English, I think he's at Oxford, criminologist, manualized, and is a sober, serious guy. He knows how to do research. You look at his stuff. He is following the lead entirely of another criminologist called Ted Robert Gurr, who wrote in the 1980s. He's still alive. You go back to Gurr's sources, he's following the lead of a medieval historian named James Gibbon, who wrote an extremely provocative PhD thesis about homicide rates in England in the 13th and early 14th century. You go back to Gibbon's sources, and then all of a sudden you see indefinitely many caveats, concerns, warnings, remonstrations, pleas to the reader to be aware of the infinite complexities of data which is corrupted, which has long since been rendered inaccessible. But by the time you come back to Pinker, who is a scout for a scout for scholars, all these reservations are forgotten and you have an 800-year decline in violence. So you have to be very careful. Criminology is not in any sense anything more than kind of collecting point for a lot of data. We seem to have learned since 1995, maybe 1990, how to get crime rates down. But whether we've learned the lesson for the right reason, whether there are other reasons at work, no one knows. I mean, for example, this guy Bratton has just been reappointed commissioner of police in New York City. He's had spectacular success wherever he goes. Was it intended success? Did he do the right thing at the right time? Or could it have been he was just lucky? You know, Freakonomics, that interesting book about economics, argues that the decline in homicide in major American cities was caused by abortion. All the young men who would have been prone to violence were aborted by their mothers. And that's a grotesque theory. The fundamental fact is, maybe there's something to it. I certainly don't know. More to the point, the statistics are unforthcoming. You cannot get more out of the statistics than we now have. There's no fundamental theory of work. How could there be? We're talking about human violence.
I guess I want to just get to a final big picture philosophical question here.
That's me, big picture.
When someone writes a book with a title of Better Angels of Our Nature, that raises the question, are humans fundamentally good? I mean, I think that's sort of the subtext of what we're talking about here. If there's a net trajectory that humanity is getting less violent, maybe there's a case to be made that, okay, humans are good. We're capable of bettering ourselves through our own accomplishments, through our own abilities. Or if things are getting worse, or if, you know, we can make some improvements, but at the end of the day, we can't really hold back this tide of violence that just always seems to plague humanity. What does that say about our nature? So are humans, just to put it bluntly, are we fundamentally good? Are we fundamentally evil? Are we angels, or are we more like fallen angels? What are we more like in our basic natures? Or is there an answer to that question? What is your opinion, Dr. Belinsky, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm not going to offer my opinion. I'll tell you what Dostoevsky said. Dostoevsky said, as a part of a dialogue somewhere, I don't have the quotation at my fingertips. He said, man is vile, just vile. And the interlocutor says, right, and vile is he who says so. I think it's the best kind of wisdom we can have.
Good words to end this podcast with. Well, Dr. Belinsky, thank you very much for offering us your perspective on this. I know that you are working on a very big project on this question, responding to some of Steven Pinker's arguments and developing your own about whether humanity has become more or less violent over time. So we look forward to seeing where this project goes. So thank you very much for talking with us about this today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Stay tuned for more with Dr. David Berlinski. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2013. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.